Chapter 2. 100 people know, perhaps 50 shadowy figures sitting at tables feeding, ghosts now to me, and nameless forevermore. I don't know who they were, but I can very distinctly see, seated at the grand table and facing the rest of us, Mr. Emerson, supernaturally grave, unsmiling. Mr. Whittier, grave, lovely, his beautiful spirit shining out of his face. Mr. Longfellow, with his silken white hair and his benignant face. Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, flashing smiles and affection and all good-fellowship everywhere like a rose diamond whose facets are being turned toward the light first one way, and then another, a charming man, and always fascinating, whether he was talking, or whether he was sitting still, what he would call still, but what would be more or less motion to other people. I can see those figures with entire distinctness across this abyss of time. One other feature is clear: Willie Winter, for these past 1,000 years dramatic editor of the New York Tribune, and still occupying that high post in his old age, was there. He was much younger then than he is now, and he showed it. It was always a pleasure to me to see Willie Winter at a banquet. During a matter of 20 years I was seldom at a banquet where Willie Winter was not also present, and where he did not read a charming poem written for the occasion. He did it this time, and it was up to standard. Dainty, happy, choicely phrased, and as good to listen to as music, and sounding exactly as if it was pouring unprepared out of heart and brain. Now at that point ends all that was pleasurable about that notable celebration of Mr. Whittier's 70th birthday, because I got up at that point and followed Winter, with what I have no doubt I supposed would be the gem of the evening, the gay oration above quoted from the Boston paper. I had written it all out the day before, and had perfectly memorized it, and I stood up there at my genial and happy, and self-satisfied ease, and began to deliver it. Those majestic guests, that row of venerable, and still active volcanoes, listened, as did everybody else in the house, with attentive interest. Well, I delivered myself of, we'll say, the first 200 words of my speech. I was expecting no returns from that part of the speech, but this was not the case as regarded the rest of it. I arrived now at the dialogue. "He old miner said, 'You are the fourth, I'm going to move.'" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, the fourth what?" "Apostrophe," said I. "He answered, 'The fourth literary man that has been here in 20-4 hours. I am going to move.'" "Apostrophe, why, you don't tell me," said I, "who were the others?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Longfellow, Mr. Emerson, Mr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, consound the lot." "Now then," the house's attention continued, but the expression of interest in the faces turned to a sort of black frost. I wondered what the trouble was. I didn't know. I went on, but with difficulty I struggled along, and entered upon that miner's fearful description of the bogus Emerson, the bogus Holmes, the bogus Longfellow, always hoping, but with a gradually perishing hope, that somebody would laugh, or that somebody would at least smile, but nobody did. I didn't know enough to give it up and sit down. I was too new to public speaking, and so I went on with this awful performance, and carried it clear through to the end, in front of a body of people who seemed turned to stone with horror. It was the sort of expression their faces would have worn if I had been making these remarks about the deity and the rest of the Trinity. There is no milder way in which to describe the petrified condition and the ghastly expression of those people. When I sat down, it was with a heart which had long ceased to beat. I shall never be as dead again as I was then. I shall never be as miserable again as I was then. I speak now as one who doesn't know what the condition of things may be in the next world, but in this one I shall never be as wretched again as I was then. Howells, who was near me, tried to say a comforting word, but couldn't get beyond a gasp. There was no use, he understood the whole size of the disaster. He had good intentions, but the words froze before they could get out. It was an atmosphere that would freeze anything. If Benvenuto Cellini's salamander had been in that place, he would not have survived to be put into Cellini's autobiography. There was a frightful pause. There was an awful silence, a desolating silence. Then the next man on the list had to get up. There was no help for it. That was Bishop. Bishop had just burst handsomely upon the world with a most acceptable novel, which had appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, a place which would make any novel respectable, and any author noteworthy. In this case, the novel itself was recognized as being, without extraneous help, respectable. Bishop was away up in the public favor, and he was an object of high interest. Consequently, there was a sort of national expectancy in the air. We may say our American millions were standing, from Maine to Texas, and from Alaska to Florida, holding their breath, their lips parted, their hands ready to applaud, when Bishop should get up on that occasion, and for the first time in his life speak in public. It was under these damaging conditions that he got up to a good, as the vulgar say. I had spoken several times before, and that is the reason why I was able to go on without dying in my tracks, as I ought to have done, but Bishop had had no experience. He was up facing those awful deities, facing those other people, those strangers, facing human beings for the first time in his life, with a speech to utter. No doubt it was well packed away in his memory, no doubt it was fresh and usable, until I had been heard from. I suppose that after that, and under the smothering pall of that dreary silence, it began to waste away, and disappear out of his head like the racks breaking from the edge of a fog, and presently there wasn't any fog left. He didn't go on, he didn't last long. It was not many sentences after his first, before he began to hesitate, and break, and lose his grip, and totter, and wobble, and at last he slumped down in a limp and mushy pile. Well, the program for the occasion was probably not more than one-third finished, but it ended there. Nobody rose. The next man hadn't strength enough to get up, and everybody looked so dazed, so stupefied, paralyzed. It was impossible for anybody to do anything, or even try. Nothing could go on in that strange atmosphere. Howells mournfully, and without words, hitched himself to Bishop and me, and supported us out of the room. It was very kind, he was most generous. He towed us tottering away into same room in that building, and we sat down there. I don't know what my remark was now, but I know the nature of it. It was the kind of remark you make when you know that nothing in the world can help your case. But Howells was honest. He had to say the heartbreaking things he did say. That there was no help for this calamity, this shipwreck, this cataclysm. That this was the most disastrous thing that had ever happened in anybody's history. And then he added, that is, for you, and consider what you have done for Bishop. It is bad enough in your case. You deserve to suffer. You have committed this crime, and you deserve to have all you are going to get. But here is an innocent man. Bishop had never done you any harm, and see what you have done to him. He can never hold his head up again. The world can never look upon Bishop as being a live person. He is a corpse. That is the history of that episode of 28 years ago, which pretty nearly killed me with shame during that first year or two, whenever it forced its way into my mind. Now then, I take that speech up and examine it. As I said, it arrived this morning, from Boston. I have read it twice, and unless I am an idiot, it hasn't a single defect in it from the first word to the last. It is just as good can be. It is smart. It is saturated with humor. There isn't a suggestion of coarseness or vulgarity in it anywhere. What could have been the matter with that house? It is amazing, it is incredible, that they didn't shout with laughter, and those deities the loudest of them all. Could the fault have been with me? Did I lose courage when I saw those great men up there whom I was going to describe in such a strange fashion? If that happened, if I showed doubt, that can account for it, for you can't be successfully funny if you show that you are afraid of it. Well, I can't account for it, but if I had those beloved and revered old literary immortals back here now on the platform at Carnegie Hall, I would take that same old speech, deliver it, word for word, and melt them till they'd run all over that stage. Oh, the fault must have been with me, it is not in the speech at all. Plymouth Rock and the Pilgrims, address at the first annual dinner, N.E. Society, Philadelphia, December 22, 1881, on calling upon Mr. Clemens to make response, President Rollins said. His sentiment has been assigned to one who was never exactly born in New England, nor, perhaps, were any of his ancestors. He is not technically, therefore, of New England descent. Under the painful circumstances in which he has found himself, however, he has done the best he could. He has had all his children born there, and has made of himself a New England ancestor. He is a self-made man. More than this, and better even, in cheerful, hopeful, helpful literature, he is of New England descent. To ascend there in anything that's reasonable is difficult. For, confidentially, with the door shut, we all know that they are the brightest, ablest sons of that goodly land who never leave it, and it is among and above them that Mr. Twain has made his brilliant and permanent ascent become a man of mark. I rise to protest. I have kept still for years, but really I think there is no sufficient justification for this sort of thing. What do you want to celebrate those people for? Those ancestors of yours of 1620, the Mayflower tribe, I mean. What do you want to celebrate them for? Your pardon. The gentleman at my left assures me that you are not celebrating the pilgrims themselves, but the landing of the pilgrims at Plymouth Rock on the 22d of December. So you are celebrating their landing. Why, the other pretext was thin enough, but this is thinner than ever. The other was tissue, tinfoil, fish bladder, but this is gold leaf. Celebrating their landing. What was there remarkable about it, I would like to know. What can you be thinking of? Why, those pilgrims had been at sea 3 or 4 months. It was the very middle of winter. It was as cold as death off Cape Cod there. Why shouldn't they come ashore? If they hadn't landed, there would be some reason for celebrating the fact. It would have been a case of monumental lethargy-headedness which the world would not willingly let die. If it had been you, gentlemen, you probably wouldn't have landed, but you have no shadow of right to be celebrating, in your ancestors, gifts which they did not exercise, but only transmitted. Why, to be celebrating the mere landing of the pilgrims, to be trying to make out that this most natural and simple and customary procedure was an extraordinary circumstance, a circumstance to be amazed at, and admired, aggrandized, and glorified, at orgies like this for 260 years, hang it, a horse would have known enough to land. A horse, pardon again. The gentleman on my right assures me that it was not merely the landing of the pilgrims that we are celebrating, but the pilgrims themselves. So we have struck an inconsistency here. One says it was the landing, the other says it was the pilgrims. It is an inconsistency characteristic of your intractable and disputatious tribe, for you never agree about anything but Boston. Well, then, what do you want to celebrate those pilgrims for? They were a mighty hard lot, you know it. I grant you, without the slightest unwillingness, that they were a deal more gentle, and merciful and just, than were the people of Europe of that day. I grant you, that they are better than their predecessors. But what of that? That is nothing. People always progress. You are better than your fathers and grandfathers were. This is the first time I have ever aimed a measureless slander at the departed. For I consider such things improper. Yes, those among you who have not been in the penitentiary, if such there be, are better than your fathers and grandfathers were. But is that any sufficient reason for getting up annual dinners and celebrating you? No, by no means, by no means. Well, I repeat, those pilgrims were a hard lot. They took good care of themselves, but they abolished everybody else's ancestors. I am a border ruffian from the state of Missouri. I am a Connecticut Yankee by adoption. In me, you have Miss Sarai morals, Connecticut culture. This, gentlemen, is the combination which makes the perfect man. But where are my ancestors? Whom shall I celebrate? Where shall I find the raw material? My first American ancestor, gentlemen, was an Indian, an early Indian. Your ancestors skinned him alive, and I am an orphan. Not one drop of my blood flows in that Indian's veins today. I stand here, lone and forlorn, without an ancestor. They skinned him. I do not object to that, if they needed his fur, but alive, gentlemen alive. They skinned him alive and before company. That is what rankles. Think how he must have felt, for he was a sensitive person and easily embarrassed. If he had been a bird, it would have been all right, and no violence done to his feelings, because he would have been considered rest. But he was not a bird, gentlemen, he was a man, and probably one of the most undressed men that ever was. I ask you to put yourselves in his place. I ask it as a favor, I ask it as a tardy act of justice, I ask it in the interest of fidelity to the traditions of your ancestors. I ask it, that the world may contemplate, with vision unobstructed by disguising swallow tails and white cravats, the spectacle which the true New England society ought to present. Cease to come to these annual orgies in this hollow modern mockery, the surplusage of raiment. Come in character, come in the summer grace, come in the unadorned simplicity, come in the free and joyous costume which your sainted ancestors provided for mine. Later ancestors of mine were the Quakers William Robinson, Marmaduke Stevenson, A.L. Your tribe chased them put of the country for their religion's sake, promised them death if they came back, for your ancestors had forsaken the homes they loved, and braved the perils of the sea, the implacable climate, and the savage wilderness, to acquire that highest and most precious of boons, freedom for every man on this broad continent to worship according to the dictates of his own conscience. And they were not going to allow a lot of pestiferous Quakers to interfere with it. Your ancestors broke forever the chains of political slavery, and gave the vote to every man in this wide land, excluding none. None except those who did not belong to the Orthodox Church. Your ancestors, yes, they were a hard lot, but, nevertheless, they gave us religious liberty to worship as they required us to worship, and political liberty to vote as the Church required. And so I, the bereft one, I, the forlorn one, am here to do my best to help you celebrate them right. The Quaker woman Elizabeth Houghton was an ancestress of mine. Your people were pretty severe with her, you will confess that. But, poor thing! I believe they changed her opinions before she died, and took her into their fold, and so we have every reason to presume that when she died she went to the same place which your ancestors went to. It is a great pity, for she was a good woman. Roger Williams was an ancestor of mine. I don't really remember what your people did with him, but they banished him to Rhode Island, anyway. And then, I believe, recognizing that this was really carrying harshness to an unjustifiable extreme, they took pity on him and burned him. They were a hard lot. All those Salem witches were ancestors of mine. Your people made it tropical for them. Yes, they did. By pressure and the gallows they made such a clean deal with them, that there hasn't been a witch, and hardly a halter in our family from that day to this, and that is 189 years. The first slave brought into New England out of Africa by your progenitors, was an ancestor of mine, for I am of a mixed breed, an infinitely shaded and exquisite mongrel. I'm not one of your sham meerschaums, that you can color in a week. No, my complexion is the patient art of 8 generations. Well, in my own time, I had acquired a lot of my kin by purchase, and swapping around, and one way and another, and was getting along very well. Then, with the inborn perversity of your lineage, you got up a war, and took them all away from me. And so, again am I bereft, again am I forlorn. No drop of my blood flows in the veins of any living being who is marketable. O my friends, hear me and reform. I seek your good, not mine. You have heard the speeches. Disband these New England societies, nurseries of a system of steadily augmenting laudation and assanning, which, if persisted in uncurbed, may someday in the remote future beguile you into prevaricating and bragging. Oh, stop, stop, while you are still temperate in your appreciation of your ancestors. Hear me, I beseech you, get up an auction and sell Plymouth Rock. The Pilgrims were a simple and ignorant race. They never had seen any good rocks before, or at least any that were not watched, and so they were excusable for hopping ashore in frantic delight, and clapping an iron fence around this one. But you, gentlemen, are educated. You are enlightened. You know that in the rich land of your nativity, opulent New England, overflowing with rocks, this one isn't worth, at the outside, more than 35 cents. Therefore, sell it, before it is injured by exposure, or at least throw it open to the patent medicine advertisements, and let it earn its taxes. Yes, hear your true friend, your only true friend, list to his voice. Disband these societies, hotbeds of vice, of moral decay, perpetuators of ancestral superstition. Here on this board I see water, I see milk, I see the wild and deadly lemonade. These are but steps upon the downward path. Next we shall see tea, then chocolate, then coffee, hotel coffee. A few more years, all too few, I fear, mark my words, we shall have cider. Gentlemen, pause ere it be too late. You are on the broad road which leads to dissipation, physical ruin, moral decay, gory crime and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.